It's because you guys are keeping me up till like 2 in the morning. I keep filling my glass with whiskey. But I feel better now. Okay, so the Bible's clear that the man is the head of his household. This has been referred to as patriarchy. The word patriarchy, of course, means father rule. That word has some baggage we might want to unload. Not everything that goes under the heading of patriarchy. Just because somebody uses that word doesn't mean they've got a biblical view of patriarchy. For example, people will say that Islam is patriarchal. Okay, Christian patriarchy is certainly very different than a Muslim patriarchy. But I think it's a good word. I think we should keep it. I think we should reclaim it. It's actually a word that shows up in good English translations. But when we use that word patriarchy and we say fathers rule, men rule, what do we mean by that? Why do men rule? It's not arbitrary. It's not like God created the man and the woman and then thought, well, you can't have a democracy of two. Somebody's got to lead. I'll flip a coin and see which one it should be. No, men lead. Men rule by divine design. It's rooted in our nature. God designed us for leadership. Patriarchy is sometimes contrasted with complementarianism. Complementarianism is a conservative, I will grant it's conservative, view of looking at the sexes. But complementarianism has failed because it was a compromise position from the beginning. Complementarianism was a boomer generation theology of the sexes designed to answer modern feminism, but compromised with feminism in all kinds of ways. Complementarianism arose in conservative circles, but it's not a fully biblical position. You might say it's a sort of third way, you know, kind of splitting the difference in a way between feminism and patriarchy. You wanted to, sand off the rough edges of patriarchy without making too many concessions to the feminists, and it just hasn't worked. It tries to hang on to the explicit commands of the Bible, like the man is the head of his household, and only men can be pastors, but it was reluctant to root male and female roles in nature. And so as a result, those roles look arbitrary. Quite honestly, complementarianism makes God look like a sexist, like he chose men to lead for no good reason. And rules that do not have clear reasons will not be kept. Rules without rationales are eventually broken. Why keep a rule that's not grounded in anything? So that's the problem that complementarians have had. If you're on social media, you might have seen Michael Foster has been exposing some things in the PCA. So the PCA is really a complementarian denomination. It is conservative, but not patriarchal. And so what's happened in the PCA? They know they can't have pastors or they can't have women as pastors or elders officially, but they push the envelope just as far as they can. A lot of churches in the PCA do. So they don't give women the office of elder, but they will give a woman all the functions of being an elder. You know, things like leading in worship, and they use women as what they call shepherdesses, and so they go to session meetings. So you've got women who are sharing in liturgical leadership and governance in quite a number of PCA churches. Now, I would say that violates passages like 1 Timothy 2 and 1 Corinthians 14 and a host of other scriptures, but it's justified on a technicality because the women are not ordained. And you might ask, well, how did the PCA get there? Well, they got there by downplaying the creational natural differences between men and women. They recognize that the Bible does put certain prohibitions on what women can do. It does assign certain roles to men that are not assigned to women. But because they've said that these roles are just sort of free-floating, they're not grounded in the way God made us, they can't give good reasons for the rules God has given to us. And that's dangerous. The roles that God has assigned men and women, the tasks that he commands us to do, the rules that he gives us are rooted in his design. They're rooted in our creational natures. There is nothing arbitrary about it. Men lead because God made them to lead. God equipped every man with a masculine nature that is fitted and suited for leadership. Masculinity is all about leadership. Headship is not about personality. It's not about giftedness. It's about masculine nature. And so we have to ask the question, what does it mean to be masculine? And how does a man live out his masculinity? How do we judge masculinity? By what criteria do we say this man is good at being a man? This man is appropriately masculine. Being biological male does not automatically mean a man is masculine. This is why effeminacy in men is condemned in the scriptures, in passages like 1 Corinthians 6. The most extreme form of effeminacy, of course, is sodomy. But heterosexual men can be effeminate as well. Effeminacy is the lack of masculinity in men. You can think about it this way. In 1 Kings chapter 2, I've made reference to this already, but in 1 Kings chapter 2, David tells Solomon on his deathbed, he says, be a man. He's not telling Solomon to be a biological male, obviously. He is telling Solomon to be masculine, to live out his masculinity, to live up to his masculine calling, to live out his masculine nature. And so we have to know what masculinity means. We have to know what it means to be masculine. What does it mean to say that God has fitted us for leadership, that God has fitted us for headship? The man is the head of his wife. He is the head of his household. This headship is rooted in creation. In Genesis 1 and 2, before the fall takes place, we see numerous signs of the man's headship. You can see how this is already built into creation just by reading the text carefully there. The man is created first. The whole human race derives its name from the man. Let us make man, male, and female. When the woman is created, she is created from him and for him as his helper. He names her after she's made, which is an exercise of authority. God gives the command to not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil before she's created. So God sets it up in such a way that he will have to be her teacher and she will have to submit to his teaching, to his rule. As I said, the whole human race derives its name from him, and the human race falls not when she sins, but when he sins. You think about Romans chapter 5, Paul says that we fell in Adam's fall, not in her fall, even though you could say she sins first in a way. Certainly in the act of eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, she sins first. And it doesn't say that we fell in their fall. It says we fell in Adam's fall. He was the head. He was the head of the entire human race. The man was told to guard and cultivate the garden. And there are many layers to this. Those are terms that are used later in scripture for the work of the priest at the tabernacle. They're to guard the garden. That same kind of language is used of the priest later in scripture. Adam's told to guard and cultivate the garden. There are many layers to this. Fundamentally, guarding means protecting. Cultivating means providing. And so if you combine that with what we've just seen about the man's headship, we can say the man is made to protect, provide, and preside. Okay, those three P words. Protect, provide, and preside. That is the essence of manhood. He has responsibility for his household, and he has authority over his household, and authority and responsibility always go together. If you separate them, disaster follows. They always go together. God never gives someone responsibility for a task without also granting him authority to complete it. Presiding means that the man is the king of his home. He is responsible for the physical and spiritual state of every member of his household. He is to lead them in wisdom. He is to direct them in righteousness. If you go to a passage like Genesis 18, God says to Abraham, I chose you so that you might direct your household in righteousness. It is Abraham's household, not Sarah's household, not even Abraham and Sarah. It's Abraham's household. He is the head. That's what it means to preside. Providing means certainly earning a paycheck. A man who doesn't provide for his own house is worse than an unbeliever, Paul tells us. But it's not just that. There's certainly a material, physical dimension to this, but there's a spiritual provision the man is responsible for as well. He is to provide safety and peace and direction to his home. And we can say the same thing about protection. Certainly it includes physical protection, but it's also spiritual. Not only guarding the home against armed intruders, for example, but also against demonic intruders. He is to guard against sin, disorder, and anxiety. He is to guard their bodies as well as their hearts. He is to guard his home against the serpent's lies. A godly man will guard his family. He will stand between his family and anything that might harm them in any way. And as a man presides, protects, and provides, if you bundle all of that together, all of that taken together amounts to love. It is masculine love, love in its masculine form. And so the love of a husband is measured not by the feelings of his wife, but by this objective biblical standard. Is he presiding? Is he providing? Is he protecting? Now, that doesn't mean her feelings are completely irrelevant. That's obviously something taken into consideration. But her feelings are not the standard. There's a biblical standard here by which a man's love for his wife and for his household can be measured. And, of course, presiding, providing, and protecting, these are not easy tasks. Just as Christ Jesus poured out his life sacrificially for his people, so a patriarch will pour himself out for his people, for his family. Presiding, protecting, and providing is a sacrificial, masculine form of love. Limp-wristed leadership doesn't cut it. Men need strength. They need specifically masculine strength to preside, provide, and to protect. This kind of masculine love, this is how it's manifested. The man was made for this. He was designed for this. This is what God made him for. But we have to ask the question, what qualities does a man need to preside, provide, and protect well as a man? The question here is, what does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a patriarch? How can you be an effective and wise patriarch? How do you preside over your family and provide for your family and protect your family in a God-honoring and effective way? I don't have an exhaustive list for you, of course. That would be impossible to do. But I do have 7 criteria by which I believe men can be judged, and so I want to overview them for you here. Incidentally, I would say these are not just the qualities that make a man an effective patriarch in his home. They are also key factors in attraction, in attracting a woman. And this is crucial because a man wants to attract a woman, and he wants to keep a woman attracted. And these are qualities women respond to. When it comes to women, you can't really go by what they say. You have to go by what they respond to, not what they say they want, but what they respond to. And these are things that women respond to. Now, I'm not saying that we just judge masculinity by what women respond to. I'm just saying it just so happens that the things that God calls a man to do and the very qualities that make a man good at being a man are things that women take note of and respond to. These are the qualities you need to keep the fires of attraction burning in a marriage. They're also the factors that gain the respect of other men, which is also of crucial importance. You want to be a man who's not just attractive to your wife, but also the kind of man who gains the respect of other men. So let me go through these. First, confidence. Confidence. Confidence is a key way that men express masculine energy. The way a man carries himself, the way he speaks, the way he makes decisions, the way he acts, all of these are expressions of his confidence or the lack thereof. If you look at the great and godly men of the Bible, they are men full of confidence. If you look at the great and godly men of church history, they are men full of confidence. Confidence in men is attractive. Its lack is repulsive. The question then is, how does a man grow in confidence? Confidence starts with trusting in God. Personal confidence starts with confidence in God's word and God's plan for your life. At the beginning of Calvin's Institutes, he says that in the same act of knowing God, we come to know ourselves. And in coming to know ourselves, we come to know God. And I think you can say the same thing about confidence. As we put our confidence in God, we come to have a kind of confidence in self. And if you try to develop a confidence that's not rooted in God, a kind of self-confidence that's not ultimately rooted in God confidence, then what you have is not really confidence, but cockiness. It's not really confidence, it's arrogance. So how does a man grow in confidence? This is a question, if you're going to say that confidence is important, you've got to ask this question. It starts with what I would call pre-confidence. Pre-confidence is simply knowing who you are as someone made in God's image, made for a purpose, knowing that you are someone redeemed in Christ, knowing that you have been given certain talents and capacities. And so it starts with knowing that you are a man, and it's good to be a man. Not just that, but you are a man in Christ. And so it's not just that you've been created for a purpose, you have been redeemed for a purpose. And that lays the foundation on which you can build a life of confidence. So that's the foundation. And then how do you actually grow in confidence? You grow in confidence by actually doing things and getting better at things. which means you have to be willing to take risks. You've got to be willing to try things. You've got to work at developing skills. A man who is overly risk averse will never develop confidence. Confidence means wisely managing risks. You miss 100% of the shots you don't take. It's risky to not take risks. You know, you can't avoid risk. In a fallen world, everything's dangerous. You will never avoid risk. So it's impossible. What's really risky is not doing anything. What's really risky is not doing anything with what God has given to you, because you risk facing God's judgment. Again, think about the parable of the talents, or the parable of the minas. I've made reference to this already this weekend, but in the parable, the master gives his servant a number of talents. And the ones who give the master a return on their investment, who took risks, who did something with it, they're the ones who are commended, and they're rewarded with even more responsibility and more dominion. But the one who just buried his talent, who was so risk averse he would not do anything with it, he's condemned. I think the master would have been happier had he tried to do something with his one talent and lost it. I think the master would have been happier with that than just burying the talent. So you cannot be risk averse and grow as a man. So think about it this way. You know, you may not be very confident in shooting free throws, but go shoot 1,000 free throws a day, you know, for months on end, work at getting better, and your confidence will grow. Confidence grows alongside of competence. I'm going to talk about competence in a few minutes. But confidence grows alongside of competence. As you get better at something, your confidence grows. And your confidence grows, and so then actually you continue to get better. And competence and confidence kind of have this spiraling relationship. You've also got to develop mental toughness to have confidence, because as you try different things, you will fail along the way. You're going to fail many times. And so you've got to learn to talk to yourself. You know, we all kind of have some kind of inner dialogue going. We all talk to ourselves in different ways at different times. You've got to train your inner dialogue to build up your confidence instead of tear it down. A lot of men, through their self-talk, actually sabotage themselves. They undercut any chance they have at success. You've got to learn. So a good example of this is David in Psalms 42 and 43. And he asks himself the question, "Oh my soul, why are you downcast within me?" So he's posing this question to his own soul. And then he exhorts his own soul. And he grows in confidence and joy through the way he talks to himself. Okay, that's growing in confidence. It takes confidence to start something, whether it's a business or a relationship with a girl. Men have to be confident in what they've been called to do. You can't be a confident man and simultaneously be ashamed of your masculinity, as so many are in our culture today. So confidence is key. Second quality that masculine men must have, second quality of masculinity, is ambition or assertiveness. I've already talked about this a little bit, but I want to say a little bit more about it here. Ambition is a bad word in some Christian circles, because we know that Paul warned about selfish ambition. Selfish ambition, of course, is rooted in pride and self-promotion. It is narcissistic. But note that he calls it selfish ambition there in Philippians chapter 2. The fact that he modifies the word ambition with selfish tells you there are other ways that ambition could be modified. Other modifiers we could put in front of that word ambition. There is selfish ambition, which is condemned, but there's a kind of godly ambition as well. An example of this is Paul in Romans 15. Paul had godly ambition. He said, "It is my ambition to preach the gospel where Christ is not yet known." Paul's ambition was to be on the frontier of the mission field, to not lay on another man's foundation, but to go extend the foundation, laying the foundation of the gospel in new places. What's interesting about that is the most dangerous mission field is always the frontier mission field, and Paul says, "That's where I want to go." You know, so Paul had confidence. He was a risk taker. He knew it was risky, but he said, "That's my ambition to go there." Again, the fact that the word selfish is put before the word ambition in Philippians chapter 2 tells us that there is a kind of negative ambition, but it also indicates there is a kind of positive ambition. How often does the church call men to be ambitious? I mean, I know your pastor's done this, because I've talked about this with Kyle. I know that in your church this happens, but if you just look at the church more broadly, how often do pastors call on men to be ambitious, to pursue that promotion, to win that election, to gain that influence, to make that money? the church all too often demonizes ambition when we should be encouraging it. I think this is one of the ways that effeminacy has crept into the church and corrupted the church. The reality is God made men to be ambitious, to seek to shape the world around us, to seek to rule the world around us. They're a little piece of the world, at least, that God has assigned to them. What is ambition? Ambition is a strong desire to achieve even when it requires hard work and sacrifice. Ambition does not mean you're not content. Contentment does not mean we never seek to better our circumstances. I think Paul shows us that in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. So in the very context of talking about contentment, he says, hey, if you're a slave and you have the opportunity to go free, take it. So you can certainly be content while still desiring to better your circumstances. Godly contentment should not be equated with passivity or laziness. In fact, contentment is fully compatible with having drive, with having goals, with having ambition, and then working hard to attain them. There's nothing about contentment that should keep you from wanting to grow yourself and grow God's kingdom. Contentment simply means trusting God whatever your circumstances are. So Paul says, whether I have a lot or I have a little, I've learned to be content. So that means I'm trusting God no matter my circumstances. I'm trusting God to take care of me. But if your contentment kills your ambition, you're doing it wrong. You're doing contentment wrong. Ambitious is the antithesis of passivity and laziness. Ambition leads to diligence and excellence. The man who is ambitious is going to want to be excellent at what he does. And that's a key thing to see. Ambitious men have goals, and they grow in the discipline necessary to accomplish them. And I can tell you, women admire and appreciate ambition in men. Maybe sometimes it scares them a little bit, but in their heart, they do appreciate it. Some men don't want to be ambitious today because it feels prideful, or they're scared of being accused of toxic masculinity, or they've been brainwashed by Marxism, which tells them that holding power makes them an oppressor, or they've been told that every strong desire they might have for something is idolatrous. Okay, sometimes that happens, you know. You want a particular job, or you want to get married, and you're told, well, don't want that too much. That would be idolatrous. Now, wanting good things like that is good and healthy and right. You certainly can't make an idol out of everything. I mean, I admit to that. But just wanting something doesn't mean you're making an idol out of it. It depends why you want it, and is what you want in accord with God's design. Lots of other questions we can ask. But just wanting something badly doesn't make you an idolater. We've got to reject those lies. Masculine men are ambitious. They have drive. They have a desire to make their mark on the world. They are ambitious to do God's work, the work God has assigned to them. Ambitious men plant churches. They start businesses. They run for office. They build institutions that will last long after they are gone. Godly, ambitious men make a difference. When I think of godly ambition, I think of somebody like Doug Wilson, who over the course of his career has had great ambition to do great things for God, for God's kingdom, and has done it. You know, he's built up our denomination. He's built up all his ministries in Moscow. I think he's a wonderful example of godly ambition. Godly, ambitious men want to make a difference in the world. They want to make the world a better place. They want to advance God's kingdom. The ambitious man does not just let life happen to him as if he's a mere spectator. No, he is in the arena. He's in the game. He's driven. He has aspirations. He has goals he's seeking to achieve. Third quality of masculinity that I think is very important: decisiveness. Men have to be able to make decisions without second-guessing themselves. No paralysis by analysis. Okay, men, let's leave the overanalyzing of things to the ladies. Okay, they do that really, really well. They're great at overanalyzing. We don't need to do that. Now, I would say you definitely need to review the game tape from time to time. You need to review the game tape and learn from mistakes and maybe sometimes change course. But in order for a man to lead, to be properly masculine, he must be decisive. Many men are passive. They are reluctant to make a decision. And I think the reason a lot of men are indecisive is because they are scared of responsibility. The responsibility that comes with decision making is they put it off because they don't want to have to take ownership of the outcome of the decision. But their indecisiveness itself is a kind of decision. It's just a really poor one. A decisive man can bring order out of the chaos of life. Decisiveness is a necessary quality in every leader. To lead is to weigh, consider, and then act. And I can tell you, women do not like being around indecisive men. We've talked about how women have a kind of baseline of fear and anxiety in their lives already. Being around an indecisive man simply increases her anxiety. A woman will not look at a man as a leader, certainly not a leader worth following, if he is indecisive. Indecisive men are viewed as timid and effeminate. Now understand, decisiveness is not the same as impulsiveness or recklessness. You know, it's not just making a really fast decision. That's not what it means to be decisive. To be decisive means making confident, wise decisions in a timely manner and then owning the results. Taking ownership of the results, taking responsibility for the results. The decisive man is a man of action. Not just words, but action. Not just thoughts and intention, but actions. The decisive man makes things happen. Decisiveness is a mark of masculine energy and mastery. The decisive man is a man who can channel his aggressive, masculine nature in productive ways. He can act with intention and with purpose, but he really does act. He doesn't just sit around and wait for others to act, and he doesn't just let life happen to him. He's a man of action. Fourth, calmness or poise. A masculine man has control of his emotions, especially fear and anxiety. A masculine man is calm in the face of adversity. Men who are easily panicked, men who are often very anxious, are operating with a deficit of masculinity. You know, think about this. Why do we respect basketball players who can hit the buzzer beater shot? Why do we track the number of fourth quarter comebacks that quarterbacks have led their team to in the NFL? It's because we look at those situations and we say, here is poise under pressure. And we know intuitively that is a mark of masculinity. It impresses us. You know, like if you imagine yourself, you know, as that quarterback, it's like, yes, I'm leading my team, you know, down the field to score the game-winning touchdown as the clock expires. You know, that's, we picture that as a kind of heroic form of masculinity because it is. I mean, it's a picture of what we expect men to be, men at their best. A masculine man has a kind of holy swagger about him. A kind of holy swagger. Calmness is the ability to focus and perform and do your duty in the face of chaos. To overcome whatever kind of obstacles are in your way, whatever kind of opposition you might face, and stay calm in the face of those obstacles, that opposition. This calmness, this poise I'm talking about, this is Jesus going to the cross without flinching. This is Paul preaching the gospel to kings, even in chains. This is martyrs professing their faith, even as they're engulfed by the flames. This is Martin Luther saying, here I stand, when he's on trial at the Diet of Worms. Men who are overly anxious, who are fearful, who are nervous, will not be trusted to lead. Men who are calm under pressure, are men others know they can rely on. And one of the best features of a man is dependability. I mean, there's, you know, men should not be taken for granted, but in a way it's a compliment when a man is taken for granted. Because it says, we know that this guy, he just gets things done. He's reliable. He's dependable. He's calm. He's poised. He knows how to get the job done. And people will take that for granted. They shouldn't. They should thank you for it. But I think when a man gets taken for granted, that's often a compliment. I've already raised this issue, but I'll mention it again. Does your presence in a difficult situation increase other people's anxiety, or are they glad to see you when a crisis hits because they know that you will exert leadership and you'll know what to do in this difficult situation? A calm man's calmness is contagious, and so he becomes a blessing to others. I've already mentioned Edwin Friedman and his book, Failure of Nerve. Friedman is so good on this. He talks about the importance of a leader being a non-anxious presence. He has a calming effect on others. And that's why he's a leader. Others look to him because they trust him to navigate the chaos, to navigate the crisis. I mentioned yesterday how women are more neurotic than men, meaning they experience higher levels of negative emotion. A calm man will calm her and stabilize her and bring her peace. You know, if you know a woman who's been married for a long time, and this woman is calm, she's relaxed, she's cheerful, she's not overly anxious, know that when you see that woman, her husband has most likely put in a lot of work leading her as a calming, non-anxious presence. He has been a poised leader in their marriage, and that's why she is the way she is. That's why she's relaxed and calm and cheerful, because she's got that kind of masculine presence in her life. That doesn't just happen, okay? Women without that kind of masculine leadership aren't that way, generally. It's the product of strong masculine leadership. A man who can absorb her negative emotional energy, who buffers her anxieties, who surrounds her with an aura of confidence and competence. You can't judge a man 100% of the time by his wife. I think we acknowledged that in the Q&A yesterday. But many times you can get a pretty good read on whether or not he is a poised and emotionally self-controlled man by looking at his wife. You know, that's why I think it's been rightly said. When you think about the kind of man you want, for example, as a church officer, one of the best things you can do is look at, you know, the state of his household, but especially his wife. And if she's not a cheerful woman, he's probably not the guy you want as an officer. It's a good measuring stick. When a man has a calm and cheerful wife, it means this is the kind of man who has been able to lead her out of anxiety because he has led himself. He can calm her because he has learned how to calm himself. Fifth quality, competency. This is one of my favorites to talk about, and we could go on and on about this, but I'll just try to boil it down to a few things here. Competency. Men need range, okay? I've talked about how a man should be a human Swiss Army knife, and I think that's a great way to think about masculinity. As I've said, every man should seek to develop a wide-ranging set of skills and competencies. He should seek mastery over his domain. To put it simply, get good at as many things as you can. Men are beasts of burden. We were made to be productive, to take dominion, to subdue the world, to build, fix, and maintain. One of the best ways to measure masculine strength is by competencies. How many things can you build, fix, or do? How much do you know about the world? How many skills do you have? Masculinity is practical. It's useful. There's a kind of earthiness to it. It's interesting. There's a YouTube channel out there that a man runs who, and this man has become known as the Internet Dad. I saw an article on this a while back. He's become known as the Internet Dad. I think the channel is called something like Dad, How Do I? Something like that. And he created it because he knows there's a lot of fatherlessness in our culture. So he created this YouTube channel so that people without a dad that they could call up and ask how to do things could go to his YouTube videos and figure out how to do things from there. You know, things like change a tire or tie a tie or fix a running toilet. You know, all those kinds of skills that, you know, fathers should pass along to their sons. You know, but now, you know, that doesn't always happen. So he's kind of trying to fill that void and say, okay, I'll kind of be your Internet Dad. And you can come to my YouTube video, which is sad if you think about it. But it's also understandable why it would happen. You can come to my YouTube channel and I will pass along this kind of knowledge to you. My own father-in-law, well, you know, I grew up with a dad who was real handy, and I appreciated that. He passed along a lot of skills to me. My father-in-law, who was a good bit older, you know, my wife's parents were about the same age as my grandparents. My father-in-law was like this. You know, he could fix just about anything. You know, we called him the senior citizen MacGyver, because, you know, you could give him a paperclip and a ball of twine and a can of WD-40 and, you know, he'd fix whatever was broken. And if something did break, you know, he'd fix it, and it finally got to where it was not fixable anymore. He would disassemble it, save all the parts, just in case, you know, because you never know. That's a great quality. That's what dads are for. Dads are useful. They know how to do stuff. But dads today often aren't like dads of the past, and so you have boys growing up who don't know how to do as much. I came across this story a while ago. A guy talks about how they had a breakdown in North Dakota. They didn't have a breakdown. It was somebody else had a breakdown, and they wanted to help her. They wanted to help this girl who had a flat tire, and so she pulled off the side of the road, and so this guy pulls off to help her with her flat tire. but he couldn't get the car jacked because it was so uneven and soft on the shoulder of the road there. And so his wife asked, what are we going to do? And he said, well, we're going to wait for some Southerners to drive by. They'll figure this out. Okay, because apparently the oil fields in North Dakota have a lot of Southerners there. And as he tells the story, he says about 20 minutes later, a lifted King Ranch, of course, pulls up with Texas plates, and five barely adult white boys climb out, don't even say a word, proceeded to figure out the problem, change the tire like nobody else was even around. And then 5 minutes later, they were gone. And this guy telling the story, he says, my 10-year-old daughter asked, Mom, were they angels? And she said, even better, rednecks. A country boy can't survive, right? I mean, you think about that song, that's what it's about. It is about masculine confidence. And we appreciate that kind of masculine competence because competency produces dominion. You can't rule and subdue the earth without competency. And the more things you're competent in, the more dominion you can exercise. A man's likely going to need to specialize in something to make a living, particularly in our economy. You're probably going to have to be a specialist. But men should strive to be generalists, to know something about everything. Like I said, you should know what to do if somebody puts a wrench in your hand or puts a history book in your hand or puts a barbell in your hand. You know, you should just know how to do stuff. You should be able to work with your hands and with your head. That's part of being a well-rounded man. You should strive to be a generalist. You know, there's the old saying, specialization is for insects. Okay, I don't think that's totally true. I don't think that's exactly right, but I think it's close. You should strive to be a generalist. Get as good as you can as at many things as you can. It's man's nature to work, to build, to explore, to discover, to invent, to fix, to bring order out of the chaos. The opposite of being competent really is being a sluggard. The sluggard will not work to improve himself, to level up, to expand his horizons. He has no ambitions, no desire to grow in competency. You know, I tell young men this all the time because this is kind of speaking their language. I say, look, treat life like a video game and you're constantly trying to level up. Man was made to transform the creation, and so really masculinity is as broad as the creation itself. You know, think of our image of the Renaissance man. You know, this, he's the human Swiss Army knife. He's multi-talented, he's got wide-ranging knowledge. Now, obviously, no man can be good at everything, and my point here is not to make anybody feel guilty for things they don't know. Obviously, no man can be good at everything. The world is too big, it's too complex. Time is too limited for that. You know, nobody's going to be able to master everything. But think about this. You know, go back to the beginning, to the creation. God handed over his good but unfinished creation to Adam, and he said, you take it from here. That's man's call. God says to us, you take it from here. I've made a good world. You go make it better. I made a glorious world. You go take it from one degree of glory to another degree of glory. Cultivate it, subdue it, develop it, rule it. And each one of us as men should see ourselves as doing our part in that project so that when you die, people can say, you made the world a better place than it was when you found it. You're leaving the world better than it was when you came into it. That's what masculinity does. It makes its mark on the world. Be a man of wide-ranging skill. And by the way, this too is a very attractive quality in men. Women, again, recognize this. I saw, this is kind of embarrassing, but I saw one female put it this way on social media. This was her post. She said, men who can fix things are hot. Okay? Those are her words, not mine. But you get the point, okay? See yourself as a steward of creation, a vice regent ruling over the creation. And I'll say this, too, last point on this. Whatever skills, knowledge, and competencies you develop, do your very best to pass them all along to your sons. Okay? Be a link in that chain of passing along knowledge, you know, from one generation to the next. Help your son develop his own set of competencies so he can provide for and take care of his own family someday, so he can be a man of dominion, a man of mastery. You know, don't break that chain, forge the next link in it, passing along this masculine competency to the next generation. Sixth, mission. Men have to be passionate about something. You should have a mission that frames and defines your life. Mission is closely associated with vocation. Vocation would be kind of the more historically theological term for this. Your vocation, the reformers, particularly Luther and Calvin, developed a Christian doctrine of vocation that's just incredibly helpful and really was revolutionary. It really contributed to the making of modern Western civilization. And basically what they said vocation is the set of roles, tasks, and responsibilities that God has assigned you across the whole of your life. So at the center of that, you might have what you do to make money. You know, that's kind of the heart of your vocation. But there are all kinds of other things that cluster around that. Ruling your household and your hobbies, your other interests, things that you're called to do in the context of your church life. All of those kind of things, all of it together makes up your vocation. You could say the same about mission. Mission is taking the resources, skills, talents, gifts that God has given to you or enabled you to develop, matching that up with your opportunities and circumstances to do your part in advancing the kingdom of God. That's what it means to have a mission in life. So every man needs to develop his own sense of mission. What my life is going to be about. It's your vision for what you want your life to be. How you want your life to unfold. You know, if you think of your life as a story, okay, the mission is the plot of that story. It's the heart of that story. Some young men err by making their mission in life finding a wife. You know, and then they orbit her for the rest of their lives. And actually, that's not helpful. Okay? You have a mission and your wife is not it. Your wife is given to you to be a helper in your mission. Adam had a mission before he had a marriage. And he was given the wife to help him in the mission. She doesn't become the mission, she's the helper in the mission. So again, I tell young men all the time, it's mission before marriage. Make that your pattern. That's how it was for Adam. Again, God gave him a mission and he gave him a wife to help him complete it. Proverbs 24:27, I think captures this well. The proverb says, prepare your work outside, get everything ready for yourself in the field, then, after that, build your house. So set yourself up in a vocation, in a calling, in a mission, and then you're ready to build a house. I don't think that means a man has to have everything about his life figured out before he finds a wife. I think that would be unrealistic. But he ought to have some idea of what he's going to do with his life. When he sits down with her dad and he says, how are you going to provide for my daughter? He ought to have a really compelling answer to that question. A young man should find his mission. He should develop a plan or vision for what his life will look like. He should figure out what God's calling him to do. And then he should go find a wife to be his helper in it. Another thing I tell young men in our church, I say, start building the kind of life a woman would want to be a part of and then add her to it as your helper. Christian men should figure out what their mission in life is much earlier than most men in our culture do today. You know, we've got this whole failure to launch phenomenon, where, you know, young men just sort of refuse to grow up and, they treat their 20s as kind of a time just to play around and, not do anything really too serious. Okay. I would say Christian young men should figure out their mission in life much earlier than, men in our culture in general are doing. Partly that's so he can still marry young, hopefully. Partly too, so he doesn't waste some of his best years drifting through life without purpose. Masculine energy, is very much tied to mission and is expressed in a man's mission. A man with a defined mission in life is going to inspire a woman's respect and admiration. A man with a mission is anchored. He's settled. He's taking responsibility for his life. He lives a life of direction and consistency and purpose. He's dependable. He's reliable. He's productive. He will practice what he preaches and he will preach what he practices. His life will have a fundamental integrity because the mission holds it all together. He can say, this is what my life is about. It's very, you know, it adds to decisiveness because it's a lot easier to make decisions when you've got a set mission and you've got a defined purpose in life. So men must develop a mission, something that ties together your skills, interests, opportunities, resources. It ties all of that together and it gives direction to your life. Seventh, finally, courage. A man who is masculine, a man who is good at being a man, is courageous. He is indomitable. He doesn't back down from a challenge. It doesn't mean he has no fears. It just means he doesn't let those fears stop him from doing his duty. Okay, that's really the essence of courage. I think it was John Wayne who said, courage is, it doesn't mean you don't have any fears, but it means when you are afraid, you saddle up anyway. Okay? You get the job done, whatever fears you might have. Think of the Apostle Paul and all he went through. Stoning, beating, shipwreck, imprisonment. But Paul was courageous in the face of all of this suffering and opposition. He was indomitable. And Paul, in a sense, became an unstoppable force for the gospel. He kept going even when he faced death, even when he faced persistent persecution. He endured. He persisted. And that's because Paul was courageous. C.S. Lewis, I think, captures this really well. He says, courage is not a separate virtue, but the testing point of all the virtues. That is to say, without courage, you will cave in every time you get tested. So anytime one of the other virtues in your life is tested, without courage, you're going to fail. You're not going to follow through and live out that virtue, because it takes courage. In a fallen world, it takes courage to do anything good. Courage is heroic. It means facing fears and overcoming them. It means failing and rising up to try again. The difference between the courageous man and the coward is found right here. The coward submits to fear. The courageous man conquers his fear. The coward is controlled by his fear. The courageous man overcomes his fear. And this is what we need to understand. God hates cowards. God hates cowards. Revelation 21 says cowards will not be welcome in the New Jerusalem. You know, we've already talked about how men must stand up to their wives and to their wives' emotions and to their wives' tests. A man can't lead his wife without courage. Men are called to do many things that require courage. Now, sometimes people ask, well, don't women need to be courageous too? Shouldn't women also be courageous? And I would say yes. They are called upon to be courageous as well. But here's the difference. We do not measure femininity by courage the way we measure masculinity by courage. This is a dumb example, but I think it kind of gets at the point. You know, let's say you had, a group of guys and girls watching some kind of horror movie together. Okay? I'm not recommending anybody watch a horror movie, but, you know, just for the sake of illustration, some guys and girls watching a horror movie. If one of the girls gets scared during that movie, do we think that she's less of a woman? Do we think she's less feminine because of that? No, we don't. But if one of the guys got scared watching that movie, would you think of him as less of a man? Less masculine? Yeah, because we'd say, that shouldn't happen. You're a man. That shouldn't happen. Turn in your man card now. In the book of Nahum, and actually in other places, when God judges a nation, when God curses a nation, one of the things he does is he makes their soldiers like women, so they flee the battlefield as the war gets underway. When God judges a nation, he says, I will make your soldiers like women. Now, if you would make your women into soldiers, that's also a judgment. Okay? That's also a big problem. But when God judges a nation, he says, I will make your male soldiers like women. And so when the fighting starts, and it gets kind of scary out there, they're going to flee the battlefield. Courage is what we expect of men. It is the measure of manhood. Again, like I said yesterday, if there's a noise in the house at night, and a man is scared and, says, honey, why don't you go check on it? We would say he has failed as a man. Cowardice is at the root of so many of our problems today. So, for example, a failure of pastoral courage has compromised the church. If there's one missing ingredient in the American pastor, it's this, it's courage. If there's one thing the American pastor is missing, it's courage. And I think it's corrupted our churches. It's been corrosive in our churches. A failure of political courage on the part of our leaders has made us less safe. Think about some things that are happening politically. Think about, for example, the debt crisis, that our nation has. Why does the debt keep growing? Why doesn't anybody do anything about it? And I've heard people say it doesn't matter. I don't understand all these issues that well. But as best I can tell, it is a problem, okay, that we have this national debt. Why won't anybody stand up and do something about it? We don't do anything about it because it would require courage that our leaders don't have. Our leaders don't have the courage to do what needs to be done, to put their foot down and say, no, we don't have this money to spend. We're cutting this, that, and the other. So you could say, failure of courage is a huge problem in the church. Failure of courage is a huge problem in our politics. Okay, like Lewis said, courage underlies and supports all our other virtues, and that also means cowardice underlines all our other vices. Cowardice underlies all of our vices. We often hear sermons that warn us about pride, lust, and greed, but how often do we hear sermons warning us, especially men, about cowardice? How often have we been reminded that cowards go to hell? That cowards are not welcome in the New Jerusalem? That cowardice is the highway to hell? I think many pastors don't condemn cowardice because they are cowards themselves. Adam, of course, was the original coward in the garden. He wouldn't tell his wife no, and he wouldn't silence the lying serpent. Okay, he was a coward. He wouldn't stand up to his wife. And further, he was a coward. He wouldn't fight the serpent. He did not guard the garden because he was a coward. The Israelites were cowards when they refused to go into the promised land and conquer the Canaanites there. And so what happened? A whole generation had to die off. A cowardly generation had to perish in the wilderness. That's how much God hates cowardice. Peter played the coward when he denied Jesus 3 times. And it's interesting, cowardice, like courage, is courageous, is contagious. I've talked about how courage is contagious. Well, cowardice is contagious as well. This is why in Deuteronomy chapter 28, there's a law. If a man is faint-hearted before battle, it's actually in Deuteronomy chapter 20. If a man is faint-hearted before battle, he's sent home. Because you don't want a coward amongst the troops, because cowardice on the battlefield spreads. But by contrast, if even one man will stiffen his spine and act in a courageous way, others will follow his example. Cowardice produces things like safetyism, where we make safety an idol. I talked about being risk averse. Okay, the coward is risk averse. Cowards trade liberty for security and actually end up losing both. Cowards replace real virtue with virtue signaling. The coward will say peace, peace when there is no peace. The coward lets others down because at heart he's a traitor. Certainly he's a traitor to God's kingdom. Cowards are soft men, effeminate men, weak men. Courageous men, by contrast, are willing to fight when there's a fight that needs to be had. They will stand up for what they love. I think the real problem with the coward is he doesn't love anything enough to defend it. He really only loves himself. What makes the courageous man courageous? He loves something enough to want to defend it, to even give his life for it. The cowardly man has a failure of love. He doesn't love anything enough to give his life for it. If you've got a son who's being bullied, you need to teach him to stand up for himself. You don't want to raise an effeminate loser. You know, so I'm Gen X. I grew up in the 80s. I mean, our best movies were all about standing up to bullies. You know, think about the movie Back to the Future. Okay, probably a lot of you, even if you're not Gen X, have seen that movie. What happens in Back to the Future? Think about this. You've got two different timelines, and you've got two different George McFlys. Okay, that's Marty's dad. Okay, and in the first timeline, George McFly is a total loser in every way. He's allowed himself to get pushed around. In the second timeline, he's an absolute stud. What made the difference? One punch. One small act of courage changed the entire trajectory of his life. Okay? Karate Kid's another movie with the same kind of theme of standing up to the bully. Okay? That's something we need to teach our sons to do, how to stand up for themselves. Okay? We don't want to raise boys who don't know how to defend themselves and who just accept who cowardly, in a cowardly kind of way, just accept that kind of bullying. We live in a very soft, effeminate age. The need of the moment is courage. Courageous men. Charles Spurgeon once thundered, "Now is the hour for the man. Where is the man for the hour?" And I would urge you, be that man. The man needed in this hour. The man who comes through in the clutch. The man who's able to stand for the truth. Be the kind of courageous man the church and the culture need right now. I love it in the wake of Charlie Kirk's martyrdom, his assassination. There's this clip floating around, and somebody, it's so appropriate now that he was asked these questions, somebody asked, what do you want to be remembered for? And he said, the number one thing I want to be remembered for is being courageous about my faith. And I do think that's his legacy. May God give us many more like him, men who are courageous about their faith. Here's the bottom line, and this is what ties all of this together. Be a good man who is good at being a man. But understand that being a good man who is good at being a man will take everything you are and everything you can be. It's all by the grace of God, but it will take everything you have. Thank you all very much.
Do you want to do Q&A now? Are we done?
Yeah, do you have Q&A?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
How are you feeling?
Much better. Yeah. I mean, I'm sorry about that, guys. Yeah. Any questions? Yeah.
Yeah. When you have either a guy who was raised or exposed to a very negative situation where the opposite of godly manhood was what he was filled with, and a woman who maybe was in a situation where she saw, ungodly manhood in whatever form. I think when you get exposed to these principles, there can tend to be a little bit of a pendulum effect. So how do you mitigate that pendulum effect?
So by pendulum effect, you mean they've seen bad examples, so that's one end, and then it...
Well, because on one side you can have a husband and a dad who is real effeminate, who runs the show, and then a kid grows up in that. Years later, he understands, I'm doing it wrong. I saw it wrong. Man, I need to repent. I need to whatever. But then he sees the other side, this hard authoritarian where now he just wants to run roughshod.
Okay, I see. Yeah, like going from one extreme to the other, from the advocating male to the tyrannical male kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good question, and it is important. I have mainly focused on men who advocate, because I think that's what plagues our churches and our culture the most. It's the passive abdicating man and the domineering woman is, I think, the most common trope, the most common pattern that you see in our culture. So, I mean, Kyle, that's probably, would you agree with that? Like in marriage counseling I've done over the years and that kind of thing, those are the most common kinds of issues that we encounter. And just from observing the culture, I think that's the biggest thing that you see. It is interesting to me, and I may have made this point in passing already, in Genesis chapter 3, Adam becomes the prototypical passive abdicating husband. So while all this is happening with his wife and the serpent, Genesis 3, I think it's verse 6, tells us he was with her. He's standing by watching. He's just passively watching all this unfold. So he's the abdicating man. But it's interesting, in the next chapter, I think you get a picture, in the next chapter, you get a picture of the tyrannical man with Cain. Kills his brother because his offering has not been accepted. And then with Lamech, it gets taken one step further. You've got this tyrannical man, somebody wounded me, I killed him, I will avenge myself, all of that. He's multiplying wives, he's the tyrannical man. So early in Genesis, you've got both of these ways that masculinity can go wrong. What we might call toxic masculinity is, I think, what most people would call it. I think that term gets thrown around way too much, but that kind of tyrannical man, that is a toxic form of masculinity. And then you've got the passive abdicating man, you've got effeminacy. And so how do you avoid being toxic, and how do you avoid at the same time being effeminate? And I would say, and if you haven't had a good model in your life, growing up, I would say, yes, that's something that you're going to need. So I would tell, if this is a young man who says, I know it wasn't done right, I'm scared of doing it wrong, going too far to the other extreme, what do I do? I would say, find you some good mentors, some men who are doing it right, who are navigating those two extremes and sit at their feet and learn all you can from them and absorb as much as you can of their wisdom and their example. Because I think there's, you know, you could read a bunch of books on this that you can, you can listen to, people talk about this, but you really need to see it done in a lot of ways. And so I would say that's really important. Have somebody who can, mentor you, seek out a mentor who can help give you that kind of example and who you can bounce things off of and say, you know, this happened in our home the other day. How should I handle something like this? And who can just kind of walk you through it. I think that's really, really valuable. I would say, I think the lived example is the most important thing, but I would say that if a man in that situation will put himself to continually studying what masculinity ought to look like, I would say that would be helpful. Like if he could take these seven qualities I talked about here, and say, okay, I want to implement these in my life. What's that going to look like? Okay. And do that all under the heading of presiding, protecting, and providing. You know, it is true. Some men, I think, have a really hard time because they've had bad examples grasping what this really should look like. But, I do think that if men are really, faithful in pursuing what it should look like, I think they can grow and make a lot of progress in getting there. Does that help?
Yeah, it does. Because on one hand, culturally, you have the Tim Walls, barely even a man. And then, excuse me, you have the Andrew Tates on the other end.
Right.
And so many, apologies, you have so many one men who are just either wanting to gravitate to this one extreme of just extreme squishiness, or the other extreme of this hyper performative
right,
masculinity.
Right.
And obviously scripture would have us, in God's design, would have us be in the middle, where we are under the authority, living with the full knowledge that we are under the authority of Christ, and it's from the authority of Christ flows our authority into our families rather than anything else.
Yeah. I agree with that, and I think you're exactly right. And it is interesting. I think a lot of men young men gravitate towards someone like an Andrew Tate. Precisely because they have not been given good models of masculinity. So what I would say is that, and of course in a church like this, I mean, spending time with you all this weekend, I mean, I can say you've got plenty of good examples of appropriately masculine men in this congregation. So like a young man who came into your congregation would have no problem finding that kind of model here. But I think men gravitate to, someone like Andrew Tate the same way they gravitate to the internet dad I talked about. You know, because they have not had a good model in their life. And Andrew Tate becomes popular because we live in a fatherless culture, you know, a culture where men have been lacking a model. So they're just trying to reach out and grab hold of something. And hey, this guy Andrew Tate looks like a man, you know, and talks like a man. And they're, you know, it's a distortion of masculinity and a perversion of masculinity. I mean, I would say that is toxic masculinity. But it is, at least he's a man. You know, at least he's a man, and in a culture that is so awash in effeminacy, guys will latch onto that and say, you know, this is, you know, they make that their model of what manhood should look like, and obviously that's very destructive. So yeah, I would say find a mentor and keep doing the study of what it ought to look like, but finding a mentor, someone who can model it for you, somebody who can be a sounding board and sort of give you some input, I think that's the single most important thing. Disciple, I think, and I would say this too, there are a lot of young men out there who are, they're not Christians, but they are, I think it's a mission field ripe for harvesting because they are what I would call reality respecters. You know, they recognize that this progressivism and, feminism, all these kind of things are detached from reality. You know, we have, there's a whole segment of our population, our culture, that has lost touch with reality and has basically gone insane. They know they don't want that. I think those kinds of young men are great prospects for the church to reach out to evangelize. And from what I have seen in my context, they're really, they are eager to hear what we have to say and eager to be discipled, you know, in these things. So they just need somebody who's willing to do it for them, to lead them in it. So, okay, anything else? Yeah. Yeah, it's a good question. You know, what should decision making look like? I think that, you know, there are some men who are impulsive and they make decisions way too quickly. And you're like, whoa, wait a second. You know, like, you know, pull back on the reins here and let's think about this for just a minute. And then there are other men who go, you know, who go to the other extreme, who they've got to analyze everything. They've got to do so much research and thinking and all that that they never actually get around to acting when they need to. And again, this is one of those situations where I would say this is about growing in wisdom and growing in confidence. So wisdom keeps you from making a decision too quickly, okay? Confidence helps you to make a decision in a timely way, you know. So, you know, wisdom will put the brakes on that impulsiveness and say, no, we need to make sure we've thought this through and understand what we're deciding, what we're choosing here. And confidence enables you to move forward and make the decision instead of being perpetually indecisive. And so I would say if you will grow in confidence and if you will grow in wisdom, you will become a much better decision maker. Okay. And I would say if you know yourself and you know that your tendency is paralysis by analysis, like you just know that's going to be what you're given to, then I would say find somebody who can help hold you accountable to make decisions in a timely fashion. And I would say get used to making decisions where maybe you still feel like there's a few loose ends you haven't tied up, but just plow ahead, make the decision anyway. I mean, I'm not talking about something life and death, but, you know, I mean, just decisions we have to make in everyday life. And I would say also recognize how much time you end up wasting without getting any kind of better results by putting off a decision. You actually accomplish far less because you're so obsessed on things that actually are not going to matter in the long run that you end up accomplishing a whole lot less than if you would go ahead and make your decision, plow ahead. And like I said, you know, all of us are going to make decisions that we have to revisit and change course. You know, you take a job with a company and it turns out not to be what you thought and you have to do something else, or you're training to gain a certain skill to do a certain job, and then you realize, you know, actually I'm not going to be good enough at this to ever make money in it. I've got to go do something else. I mean, things like that happen. You can always course correct, but I think men need to act. Men need to act. You can't just think about things indefinitely and put off making a decision. So develop your plan. You know, check it. There's wisdom in a multitude of counselors. Check it with others. Pray about it, but don't use prayers as a substitute for action. You know, make your plan and then execute it. And I think if men will do that, they'll be a lot better off. Because actually, one of the ways you learn is through making decisions and sometimes making mistakes. And if you never actually do anything, there are no mistakes to learn from. You know, it's like I said a bit ago, you know, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take, okay? You're not really helping yourself by just putting things off and not being able to decide. There was a question up here too.
Yeah, going back to the two ditches of the advocating soft man and the toxic masculinity, and there being this field of young men ripe for harvest, what do you think happens if the church does fail to get hold of these men and then they are influenced by the taints of the world? What does that culture look like if you play it out over the next 20 years and now all these men are... And has that happened in the past in America?
I don't think we've had anything quite like that in the past because you know, in many ways we were... you think about what's happened to the American family, okay? You know, the American family was largely intact for much of our history, you know, up until... really the 1960s, 1970s there. And families, of course, are crucial to having a stable, coherent society. So the breakdown of the family we're experiencing, where a high percentage of kids are born out of wedlock, high divorce rates, low marriage rates, low birth rates. You know, all of those are symptoms. They are signs of a sick and dying society. And I think the question for us is, can we revive things? And I think in order for us to revive things, one thing we have to do is capture those men who do have a lot of masculine energy, it's just not connected to virtue. Capture those men, bring them into the church, disciple them, and point them in the right direction so that they will use their masculine energy in virtuous kingdom-building kind of ways, to build businesses, to build Christian institutions, to influence politics, and of course, to build a family. You know, that I think is one of the greatest needs of the moment. I think one of the problems we face, we're actually talking about this around the fire last night a little bit. One of the problems we face, you know, somebody asked me last night, what's the biggest problem young men face today? And I was like, young women, you know, because there's this gigantic, political and cultural divide now between young men and young women, which that's something we really haven't seen. Men are getting increasingly conservative, not necessarily Christian, although I think some of that's happening, but they're getting increasingly conservative politically and culturally, and women are getting increasingly progressive. And so how do we bridge that divide? How do you bring men and women together when they have such diametrically opposed worldviews? And in a lot of cases, you know, part of the problem is that a lot of young women don't even want to get married. And they don't see having a family as something to aspire to. Whereas by contrast, a lot of young men do. Like, they want to get married and have children, but, you know, that's hard to do when you've got all these women that don't want to get married and have children. So we are in a real mess. And I think the question is going to be, what would it take to sort of snap things back into their natural shape? I mean, because this is very unnatural, you know, to have this kind of situation. I mean, to have a generation of women who are so detached from their own natures, from reality, that they're rejecting marriage and motherhood in this kind of way. I mean, that's just unheard of, in our history for sure. So I think that's what we have to figure out. Like I said in my first talk, I think that young women today especially are disproportionately harming society. And obviously, you know, what would be great is to be able to say, yeah, well, so their fathers should do something. Well, in a lot of cases, you know, their fathers are the problem, you know, and or the absence of a father is the problem. So so there are a lot of things there that are not going to be easily sorted out. I think we should see all of this as the judgment of God. Like, if you read Romans 1, you know, starting in verse 18 through the end of that chapter, it talks about the degradation of a society as it rebels against God and comes under judgment. And kind of the final burning out of a society, like this, a sign that a society has gone insane because it's rejected God. That's what happens when a people reject God. They go crazy. Is unnatural sexuality. And obviously, Paul there is focused on sodomy and lesbianism, but it would also include things like transgenderism, feminism. In our culture, in our context, all of these things are downstream from feminism. You know, I use the acronym, you know, so you've got the LGBTQ movement. I say it's really the F-LGBTQ movement, because feminism came first and produced all of these other sexual and social pathologies that we see. So we've really got to deal with that issue. It is not easy to deal with. There's not an obvious answer to that problem. I said in my first talk, you know, the sexes rise or fall together. You know, you can't have one sex win while the other sex loses. Like, the sexes either do well together or they both suffer. And right now we're in a situation where they both suffer. And the men have moved back towards the right direction, which that is new. But the women are still moving in the wrong direction, just statistically speaking in our culture, that's how it is. So that's the question, is how do we get young men and women back on track and then get them together, marrying, forming families, having children, raising the next generation? That is the existential threat, the existential crisis we face, and there's not an obvious answer to it. Okay? There are some people who are putting their hope in Taylor Swift, you know, that if she would get married and have kids, that all these women all of a sudden will change their mind and think that motherhood, you know, marriage and motherhood are great. I'm not as confident that it's going to be that easy. And I would hate to say that Taylor Swift is the one that saved civilization. I just can't bring myself to do that. So, I mean, it's kind of like she wrecked it, so shouldn't she fix it? But, you know. Okay, anything else?
It seems like the evangelical church in general like seems to be sliding into, you know, soft complementarianism and egalitarianism. Like, where do you see like the most hope for a reversal of that denominationally?
Yeah, I mean, it's really, I mean, so I use the PCA as an example because I spent several years in the PCA. I was ordained in the PCA, and I've got a lot of love and affection for the PCA. I've got kids in the PCA, you know, so I've got a vested interest in what happens there. And this kind of thing that, you know, that the Save the PCA, you know, which is just kind of a social media thing, is, you know, is all it is right now. But that kind of thing that's been exposed has been going on for a long time. And it really, you know, some of it stems from an idea that was adopted, that was basically summarized with this slogan, a woman can do anything an unordained man can do. Okay. And the problem with that is that that means basically, other than pastors, the rest of the church is androgynous. Okay. Everybody else is sexually interchangeable. Okay. And that is a denial of masculine, feminine nature. This is also why complementarianism has said, you know, the Bible does say the man's the head of the household and only men can be pastors. But then outside of that, it's anything goes. Okay. And so women can enter society and pursue career and all that just like men. And so it is a denial of masculine created nature and feminine created nature. It's a denial of what the sexes are actually for. So in complementarianism, these roles sort of just hang, you know, floating in the air, not grounded in anything. Patriarchy says, no, the reason that men lead in every domain normally, like that's what's normal or prototypical. Men lead in every domain, home, church, and in society. It's because that's what God made men for. You know, God made men to be the ones who are primarily focused on those kinds of things. And women are primarily focused on the domestic realm. Like, you know, in Genesis chapter 3, when the man is cursed, he's cursed in the realm of dominion, the realm of provision. He's going to work, you know, but now thorns and thistles are going to get in the way. But working out in the world is primarily what the man is for. Where is the woman cursed? She's cursed in the realm of domestic life, the domestic sphere of childbearing and child rearing, because that's her primary domain. That's her primary focus. So complementarianism is, you know, like I said, it's kind of a boomer generation theology. I tend to think it's going to kind of die out with the boomers. And what you're going to see happen is you will have Christian patriarchy and some form of secular feminism or egalitarianism as your two options, really. And churches that reject patriarchy will more and more fall in line with that kind of secular, feminist, egalitarian view. And that's going to be the divide. I mean, I think that's going to be one of the great divides in the church. I mean, in some ways it already is, but I think it's going to be a greater divide in the years to come unless something changes. What's going to happen with the PCA? I mean, I have no idea. I think it depends on the problem in the PCA is that while you've got a lot of rank and file ruling elders and small church pastors who would lean more towards the patriarchal view and who are very bothered by the fact that you've got churches that are sort of doing an in run around not just the scriptures, but also their denominational book of church order. The big churches, sort of the big names in the PCA, are all on board with the shepherdess stuff and, you know, having women as liturgical leaders and that kind of thing. And so that's very hard to overcome. So I think it really depends, like, what kind of fight are they really prepared to have over this and how far are they going to take it? Would they take it all the way to a split if nothing changes? I mean, I don't know. You know, I can't predict that, but it will be very telling to see what happens with that. Because I do think in some ways the PCA, you know, it's not the largest evangelical denomination, but I do think it's kind of a bellwether, you know, for where things are in a certain way. You got the same kind of thing going on in the SBC, the Southern Baptist Convention, where they're very confused. I mean, they're confused about polity anyway. You know, like Southern Baptists really can't even tell you what a pastor is or what an elder or deacon is. Their polity generally is met. That's not all Baptists, but most Baptists are just very confused about the polity issues. So that accounts for some of this, but they've also got a lot of confusion about male headship, male leadership, in the church and in other domains of life. And I think that's kind of a telling thing as well. So keeping an eye on what happens with those churches will be a big deal. One thing I appreciate about the CREC is that we have settled these questions. You know, we have resolved these questions, and I think we've done so in a very biblical way. As far as I know, we don't have any of these kinds of issues in our churches, which doesn't mean we don't have to guard ourselves against all of this. And it doesn't mean that we wouldn't have to guard ourselves against other kinds of errors too. You know, other errors can creep in. But I do think that we're in a very healthy place on these questions because we've worked this out. And if you join a CREC church or you pursue being in the CREC as a pastor, all of this is kind of already priced into it. You know, you've already budgeted for this kind of thing, and this is where you want to be. So because if you don't, there's obviously other places you could go that are a lot easier, you know, to be. So I think that's good for us. But, I think this is going to be something to really keep an eye on in the years to come is how does all of that unfold? And, I'm very hopeful that there can be I don't know if they would always use this term, but the patriarchalists in the PCA can win that battle. I hope that they can. That'd be my hope. So, okay. Anything else?
It seems like it's a growing, idea where the decision on who the head of the household is based off of status. Like, if a husband wants to say that my wife makes more than me, then they have, it's hard for them to say that they're the head of the household in that sense. What's your response to that?
I would say that's true. I mean, obviously the man is the head of household, even if she makes more money. But it does create a tension. So I'll talk about this a little bit. If you want to pursue this further, there's a woman who she writes mainly for women, but I've read some of her stuff and found it helpful. She identifies herself as the feminist fixer, like pushing back against feminism. Her name is Suzanne Denker, and she's dealt with this question a lot. So this is the thing. When a man is not the primary provider or primary breadwinner in his home, maybe, you know, the worst example of this would be a stay-at-home dad. Okay. I hope we don't have any stay-at-home dads here. Because if you do, I've got, you know, that's, I would have to pick my words very carefully, but I would want to have words with you. Because that's really gay. But this is the thing. Suzanne Denker has done all the research on this, and she says in marriages, you know, so say it's a two-income marriage, okay? And in marriages where the woman makes more money, a couple of things happen. One is both spouses are ashamed of it to the point where they will lie about it. Okay? They're both ashamed. They both know there's something unnatural here. Okay? Second of all, the divorce rate for those marriages skyrockets. Okay? Because a woman intuitively knows that she should be depending upon a man to provide for her, and when she's doing the bulk of the provision, she thinks, why do I need you? So, you know, we talk about, you know, women initiate 70% of the divorces. Well, this is one of those things that drives that, okay? Where there's not grounds for divorce biblically, but it's one of those things that creates a huge strain on the marriage. And I'm not talking about a situation here where, like, say, you know, you've got a man that's in graduate school and he's going to have a career in a couple years, you know, where he makes more money, but she's making more money. Like, everybody recognizes that's a temporary situation, and it's not the way the marriage is set up, you know, for the long haul. So I'd carve out for that. That's not what I'm talking about here. I'm just talking about a marriage where the settled situation is she makes more money than he does. It puts a huge strain on the marriage because it is a form of role reversal. And this is the thing. Men get a lot of satisfaction out of providing for their families. You know, when a man can take his family on a vacation, or a man can buy the family, you know, a new minivan, okay? Those men get great satisfaction out of providing because that's one of the ways that we fulfill who we are as men. It's one of the ways we express our masculinity. We get great satisfaction out of providing for the family. A woman gets no satisfaction out of providing for the family, and in fact, she resents it because it's not what she was made for. So it does create a great deal of frustration in a marriage. I'm not saying every single one of those marriages is doomed to fail, but I would say to that man, you need to level up. You need to figure out a way to make more money because your wife is going to have a hard time respecting you, following your leadership, and admiring you, and quite honestly, being sexually attracted to you if she does not think of you as her provider. You know, if she's out earning you. I mean, the thing is, there's this thing called hypergamy. Is that a term you're familiar with? I mean, I don't think I've used that term this weekend. This is one of those things that's just universally established across history and across all different cultures, that women want to marry up. Okay? Women want to marry up. And what that means is obviously marrying a man, say, who's generally taller, or bigger, stronger, all of that. But also a man typically who's more accomplished, who is able to out-earn her, okay? Because women know intuitively they're to look to a man and rely upon a man to be the provider, okay? They know intuitively they've got to do that. And some of that is knowing, you know, I'll get pregnant, have children someday, I won't be able to provide in the same way. I've got to be able to rely on him. So hypergamy is just kind of this universal feature of the male-female relationship. And I would say it's kind of a design feature. I mean, it's obviously in a fallen world, it can go haywire like anything in a fallen world. And so women can have totally unrealistic expectations. You know, they can be so hypergamous that they sort of price themselves out of the dating market. You know, that's one issue. But, hypergamy is a design feature. And in a way you can say it should bring out the best in men. Okay. Women who know that they married a man who is their superior in these particular ways, okay, in the kind of ways that she wants a man to be superior to her, those kind of women who have satisfied their hypergamy are the kind of women who quite naturally submit to their husbands because it makes sense to do so. Like, she knows she married a man who's a better leader than she is and who's a better provider than she could be, you know, that kind of thing. But when a woman's hypergamy is not satisfied, it's very difficult for that woman to not have a wandering eye and think, you know, could I have done better? Is there a man out there who would be better for me? Now, the problem we have today, and this goes back to my first talk, because the system is rigged against men, men have to work that much harder to be the kind of man who could satisfy a woman's hypergamy. Okay, because the system is rigged against men, they've got to work that much harder. So think about this. So this is the kind of thing that you'll see from time to time, and these come from, you know, mainstream media outlets, and it'll be the same one that runs two different stories that are like this. You'll have a story that gets put out that says something like, women are excelling in fields X, Y, and Z. They're in med school more than men, in law school more than men. Yay for women. Okay? And then you'll have another article in the same publication that comes out a few weeks later that says, women frustrated by lack of marriageable men. And the reason they can't find enough marriageable men is because none of these men make as much money as they do. It's like, well, just a minute ago you were celebrating the fact that women are excelling men in all these fields. Now you're complaining about it. Okay, make up your mind, okay? And, you know, when you consider that the game has been rigged in favor of women, it's like, well, of course, they get more opportunities. They get more scholarships. They get, you know, jobs are created just for them. There are quotas that have to be met, you know? So, of course, you know, it's easier for them. And I think until that system gets changed, and I do think we need to change that system and do what we can to, you know, to fix that problem. I mean, the most obvious example of this is in athletics, okay? When Title IX got passed years ago, it required universities to have the same number of athletic scholarships for women as for men, okay, which is absolutely stupid. I mean, it's one of the dumbest things ever because, and I'm not saying it's bad for women to play sports, but sports don't play the same kind of, I think I mentioned this already, but sports don't play the same kind of role in a woman's life as they do in a man's life. When men play sports, it actually serves the good of society because sports is just war by other means. And so because the men are the guardians of the nation, the defenders of the nation, we want our men to be masculine. And sports is a way of developing masculinity, and sports is a way of even preparing men, in a sense, for war. So it's good for society. But society really doesn't derive any obvious benefit from women playing sports. There's no reason for us to invest in it in the same kind of way or equalize it. Okay? So you've got, you know, again, the system's rigged against men. But I would just say that if, you know, this is the situation we're in, don't think of yourself as a victim. Instead, recognize that it's going to be hard and then get to work. Just work that much harder. If that's what it takes, if that's the situation we're in, make the best of it. So I would say to a man, yes, figure out some way, You know, if a man's in a situation where his wife is earning more, I would say, you need to figure out how to out-earn your wife. You need to level up in some kind of way so that you can be the primary provider and the breadwinner in this family. And I would also maybe ask some questions about why your wife's working and what your plans are for a family and that kind of thing. You know, there's other considerations there. And what is being in the workplace doing to your wife? Because a lot of times, you know, women have to masculinize themselves to really succeed in the workplace. And it's hard to turn that off and become soft and feminine when they come home. So, you know, it's not just about the money. It's also even could be what does being in the workplace actually do to this woman? So lots of things there to consider. But if you want to pursue that further, I would say go Google Suzanne Venker and see if you can find some articles where she talks about this, because she's got a lot to say about these marriage situations where you have role reversal and the wife becomes the primary breadwinner, and how neither the man nor the woman really likes that. They're really ashamed of it, and it does create all kinds of strain in the marriage, to the point where those marriages divorce at much higher rates. They have much, they have sexual problems oftentimes in those marriages. They drift towards a kind of sexless marriage because attraction is lost, polarity is minimized. So I think all those things are factors in that. So hopefully that helped answer your question. Okay, anything else?